Good morning. Welcome to Senate Revenue Committee. As I was commenting to our colleagues, this is the first day of the seventh week of the legislative session. Monday, February 19th, we have three bills on the agenda today. Mr. Warner, would you like to orient the staff to this morning's work? The committee, excuse me. Staff knows what we're doing. Let's let the committee.
Chair, the three bills, two of them are from the House Revenue Committee, House Bill 2028, House Bill 2030. They are at the request of the Collectors Association. And then Senate Bill 510 is at the request of Special Districts. And so those are the three bills, and Elizabeth, the staff, on all three of those.
You're in the box, huh?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy President's Day. Go ahead and orient the committee to the bills that we have. You're working all three, apparently.
Yeah. Okay. You want to start with 2028?
Yes, ma'am. Start with 2028.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and committee members, this morning you have on the House Bill 2028A, which was passed by the House Revenue Committee. And what it is doing, it's a tax collector bill which is stipulating when taxes shall attach as a lien on manufactured structures of floating homes removed from the county between January 1st and July 1st. And it's distinguishing two distinct circumstances. One, when the manufactured or floating home is removed entirely from the state, and the other is when the home is moved from one Oregon county to another. Now, if the manufactured home is moved out of state between January 1st and July 1st, the taxes on the manufactured or floating home will be removed from the assessment and tax roll. But if the manufactured home is moved from one Oregon county to another, then the taxes on the manufactured floating home will attach as a lien the day preceding the date of removal from the county. Now, so everyone's clear, prior to Measure 50, the assessment and lien dates were both July 1st. But since Measure 50 in 97-98, we have an assessment date, which is January 1st, and we have a lien date, which is July 1st. So there's a six-month period in which there could be an assessment on the property, but no lien. So if the property is moved from the county between January 1st and July 1st, it can be difficult for a tax collector to collect those unpaid taxes. And if a manufactured structure is sold between January 1st and July 1st and removed from the county, then a buyer of the home would be responsible for the taxes, and the home may even be in a different county. So this measure eliminates the problem of property taxes being assessed on new homeowners of manufactured structures. Now, as far as the revenue impact, it's going to be quite minor, but just to give you a little bit of perspective here, in 99-2000, the total assessed value for manufactured structures was more than $3 billion, and the total taxes statewide were $45 million. Now, the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors surveyed six counties and found that 72, or basically 16% of 44,394 manufactured homes in those counties left the county. Okay, so 72 left the county and 28 homes left the state in Oregon in 99-2000. And the total uncollected taxes on those manufactured homes in just those survey counties, just those six counties, was only $7,200 in 99-2000. So the revenue impact is clearly indeterminate but statewide, but it will be minimal each biennium. But it's just trying to make it a bit easier and more straightforward for taxpayers and less costly for county tax collectors to actually collect those unpaid taxes on manufactured structures. Again, it's just manufactured structures that are removed from Oregon counties is what we're dealing with in this bill.
Questions from the committee?
Aye.
This is a another little plug in the hemorrhaging of revenues. I guess the caveat here would be no lien, no tax collected. If you get a priority date is the day preceding. Is there any difficulty with a condition precedent like that, the idea that you can create a lien by just setting the date a day before the removal? Anybody discuss that? Well, let's call Diane Bell to open the public hearing on House Bill 2028. Ms. Bell, if you'd come forward.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy President's Day.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Good morning. For the record, my name is Diane Belt, and I am with the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also the personal property tax collector for Washington County. House Bill 2028 is to improve customer service. It provides that the lien for personal property taxes attaches on the day preceding the date that a manufactured structure or floating home leaves the county. It further states that if a home is removed from the state between January 1 and July 1st, that it should be excluded from the tax roll. With the current conditions of today's manufactured housing, the counties are experiencing an increase in the amount of homes that are being removed from one county to another, and in some instances, the homes are being removed from the state. And taxpayers have told me that they would rather pay the debt before the home is moved. Now, prior to Measure 5, the assessment date and the lien date for personal property was January 1. Advance collections were done on personal property taxes from January 1 until our tax certification in October. Measure 5 moved the assessment date and the lien date to July 1st. So if a manufactured home sold or moved after July 1, an advance collection for the pending tax was done between those dates. Now what's happened is Measure 50 separated the assessment date and the lien date. So Measure 50, in my estimation, was basically designed for residential property. I don't really think that it took personal property into consideration, because it's like trying to take a round peg and put it into a square hole. So what it did is it created a, we call it the gray hole, where you have an assessment but you do not have a lien for a period of a few months. So what happens is, because the lien attaches on July 1st, if somebody moves a home out of the county between that date, they're going to get a tax bill from the county where it was located in on January 1st. So an example would be a manufactured home buyer decides they want to upgrade their home. So they go into their local dealer and they negotiate a deal and they use their home as a trade-in. So the person would go to the county in which the home is located at and obtain a Form 113, which is a certificate to DMV that declares all the tax liens are paid through the lien date, which would be June 30th. And then that allows the title transfer, or it also allows the home to be moved on the county roads or the state highways. So then that home has now been traded in to the dealer, and it's now on the dealer's lot, and somebody else comes in and purchases that home, and they now move it to Clackamas County. So the home originally was located in Washington County on January 1st, but now it's located in Clackamas County. So the person that purchases that home gets a tax bill from Washington County, and the first person they call is the dealer. You know, why am I getting this tax bill? You know, my home is in Clackamas County. And then the dealer calls the county, and the county explains the situation, and then the dealer calls the tax payer back, and there's just a lot of confusion. And in most cases, the taxpayer wants to know, you know, the purchaser of the home, why didn't you take care of this at the time I bought this home? Why am I dealing with this now? I live in Clackamas County. So it's been very frustrating for the dealers, because he has an unhappy customer, and it's frustrating for the customer because they don't understand. And in Washington County, currently, just in the last 8 months, we have one park in which 40 homes have been removed. Some of them have gone out of state. A lot of them have gone to Multnomah and Clackamas County, and there are more scheduled to leave. House Bill 2028 will allow the county to collect the taxes before issuing a Form 113 on homes that are leaving the county. A Form 113, as I explained, is a certificate of taxes that are paid. If you purchase a real piece of property, at the time of closing, your lender may require you to pay your taxes in advance. And this assures that at the time the tax bill is due, that there are enough funds in your account to pay the tax liability. You then pay 1/12 of your tax in advance every month. Then there won't be a shortage when the tax becomes due. And I feel that the same principle should be applied to manufactured structures that are leaving the county, and this bill will accomplish that. And with that, I'd answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee?
Aye.
The AC-113, paper chase. Yes.
I just wondered when, you know, the person called the dealer who called the Washington County, who called Clackamas County, when did the dealer call his lobbyist?
Well,
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I can tell you that Don Miner's organization, we have talked about this quite extensively. Although he would like to see things stay the way they are, he does understand the problem and has no issues with this.
Okay, good. That wasn't even the question I asked, but that's a great answer.
Notion that taxpayers are clamoring for this customer service leads me to open the work session on this. House Bill 2028, the work session.
Other public testimony?
Is there any other public testimony since we're still in public hearing? Also, another. Close the public hearing. Work session's open.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 2028 A and Rose to the floor of the Senate.
2028 there is a motion to move 2028 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any questions on the issue? Hearing and seeing no questions, any objections? No objections. So ordered. Ms. Mahar, would you like to proceed to 2030?
Sure.
You should just have asked
Ms.
Belt to just remain at ease.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2030, this is very straightforward. It's just changing one word from shall to may and in 311-640. Basically, under current law, it is mandatory that Oregon counties seize and sell all delinquent property tax accounts. Okay, the word in law, current law is shall. But with House Bill 2030, this would give tax collectors a discretion to choose which delinquent property, personal property tax accounts are economically advantageous for collectors to seize and sell. So basically, with under current law, no tax collector sees all delinquent personal properties. Most county offices do not have personnel dedicated to the collection of personal property, and the cost involved in seizing and conducting a sale on certain personal property tax accounts can often be higher than the delinquent taxes. So according to the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, the cost to dispose of a manufactured structure can range from $3,000 to $4,000, excluding storage costs. And if there is no buyer of the manufactured structure, the county then has the cost to remove the home, which is about $4,000. And so the average amount of the delinquent tax is between $300 and $500. So really, the cost to seize a business and in a business personal property, this also can be $1,000 to $1,500 to $1,500 to conduct a sale, and the delinquent taxes could be as low as $100. So currently, counties really have to weigh the cost of seizing a personal property versus the amount of delinquent taxes they can actually collect. So with House Bill 2030, it will not change the amount of personal taxes that are actually collected because the legal changes in this measure are really consistent with the existing tax collection practices of Oregon counties. So this will not have any revenue impact.
Is this redneck trailer day at the redneck trailer? I need to go get my Jeff, whatever the heck his name is.
No, but a little cross-cultural competency training wouldn't hurt you.
My son was born in a trailer. We lived in a trailer for 3 years, Mr. Chair. 8x4 trailer. That's why this is so near and dear to my heart. And it was up on block.
Well, let me just suggest to you that a very high percentage of home, new housing, starts in Oregon, especially in rural areas, is manufactured housing, up to 70%.
I'm talking trailers here, not manufactured housing.
I have a question now. Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2030. And Ms. Belt, do you have some wisdom that you want to...
It was the El Rancho Trailer Park in Springfield, as a matter of fact. My son is one.
Or are we just going to sit here and learn more about the good Senator Groves' background than we ever wanted to?
Well, Mr. Chair, a song kind of comes to mind. You know, I always thought it could be a theme song, you know, Trailers for Sale.
I'm going to leave now.
The one that came to my mind is what happens when you play a country western song backwards and then you get your dog back, you get your house back, you get your, back, you get your car back, and we obviously got Senator Corcoran.
Go with a hurricane and a Texas divorce. In the Texas divorce, she gets the trailer. No, I can't remember.
Yeah, probably a good thing. Ma'am, this bill does what for us?
Well, Mr. Chair, once again... for the record, my name is Diane Belt, and I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm the personal property tax collector for Washington County. House Bill 2030 will change the current provision and make better sense of current law to conform to current practice. It will change statute that directs the property tax collector to seize and sell all personal property for delinquent personal property taxes. The provision would become discretionary instead of mandatory. Personal property is defined as either a manufactured structure that is located on rented ground or leased ground or equipment that is used in the operation of any business. This bill will change statute to conform to the practices of all 36 counties. And what I mean by that statement is that currently there is not one county in this state that goes out after the first third and seizes every bit of personal property. Most county offices do not have personnel that are dedicated to the collection of personal property taxes. With Measure 15, our staffing levels are such that employees are responsible for a multitude of duties. And I have never conducted a sale in which the amount that was collected was enough to pay the taxes due and the expense that was incurred. Current law will not increase the revenues due to schools, public safety, and other services. The county's general fund will continue to bear the expense. The collection procedure for personal property differs substantially from that of real property. On one hand, when personal property becomes delinquent, a warrant for the collection of personal property taxes is issued and is recorded as a judgment with the county clerk. On the other hand, real property delinquencies are deeded to the county after 6 years of delinquency. As I explained, there's two types of properties. There's personal property, there's manufactured structures and business equipment. And the average cost of conducting a sale of a manufactured structure is around $500. Now, this is true only if the county is not required to pay space rent and if you can, in fact, sell the home, which is pretty difficult to do. If the home's not sold and the county is required to remove the home from the park, which will happen, the cost can swell to as much as $4,000 or more. So in contrast, the average amount of delinquency can be between $300 and $500. Secondly, the estimated cost to seize business equipment is between $1,000 and $1,500. Now, if the sale is conducted on site and a storage agreement is not required, the cost could be less. If the equipment has to be removed and the landlord requires rent from the county, the expense can easily reach $5,000 or more. It depends on the type of equipment that is involved. And if it's a large business with specialized equipment, a professional auctioneer might need to be hired by the county to conduct the sale. So the average amount of delinquency can be anywhere from $100 to a potential of $2,000 and more. Now, I know this is an awful lot of information for one word, but I'll quickly go through the steps of how you seize a piece of property. First, a lien search is required from the Secretary of State or the Department of Motor Vehicles, in which you would secure any secured interest holders against the property. A notice of intent to hold the property is sent to the owner and all secured lien holders, and there's a due date of 10 days from the date of mailing in which the taxes can be paid to stop the process. Number three, if no response or payment is received, the tax collector visits the property and places a great big fluorescent red sticker on the building or structure that is being seized, and it may be necessary to change the locks at that point. A notice that the home or property has been taken is hand-delivered to the owner or person in charge, and you may need to gain permission from the landlord to enter the property, and if permission is not granted, then you need to make arrangements to remove the property for storage. In the case of equipment, you need to appoint a keeper. It could be the sheriff, the landlord, or a security guard, and this is somebody that's going to keep track of that property to make sure that it's not removed in the middle of the night. In case of equipment, you need to take inventory. You need to post a notice in three public places, and you may also want to publish in the local newspaper, and at that point you would include a list of the inventory. Notice of seizure is sent certified mail and regular mail to all persons or companies who have been identified. You conduct a sale 10 days after the notice, and if there's no purchaser, the county owns the property and arrange for removal or disposal and cancel the tax. So as you can see, it's not very feasible or cost effective for the county to conduct a sale on every piece of personal delinquent property. And doing a little research, this has probably been on the books since the early 1900s, late 1800s. At that time, all real property was subject to summary seizure. And I believe it was about 1929 that we have Chapter 312, which deals with the real property foreclosure. And I believe that this is what was left over from that. So with that, I would sure answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Question, Senator Menace.
So what happens to the property that's not seized now? Or, you know, there's a delinquency in taxes, but the county's taking no enforcement action.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that isn't true. The county does do a collection action when we issue our warrant, and that is done every year. That opens the door to garnishment. In Washington County, my personal property tax roll is $22 million, and I end up canceling about $10,000 of that due to bankruptcies and corporations that have dissolved. But there is a collection action in the judgment.
And a deficiency through a garnishment or some other kind of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, the judgment itself is a lien against the equipment and the person. So if they try to do business, borrow money, anything like that, that judgment is picked up and it's paid. There are times when you do have to go out and seize, and I've done that a few times, and it's not a very pleasant experience. And we've never come out ahead on it, but there are times when you do have to do it. But the way the statute reads is that we're supposed to go out and do this every year on every piece of property, and I just don't believe that that's was the intent of how they want us to do business.
Okay.
Other questions?
Mr. Chavez?
Senator George?
So let's say, for example, a mobile home, and you go out and you say, look, this is going to cost more to do it. We're not going to repossess it. We're not going to pick it up. Then what you're doing is, you know, the liability still stands with the owner of that. Then you're going to rely on them then probably to dispose of that the best they can, because they're going to be liable for the tax. Is that correct? So they could, when they if you pick up the mobile home, you would then have to clear the tax. But under this, you would leave the responsibility with them, and then they would have to make sure the tax was paid. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, maybe I'm not understanding you, but basically what happens, like with a manufactured home, a judgment is recorded and it does become a lien against the owner and the home itself.
Okay.
If it's something, I should have brought the picture. I've had people bring pictures in of homes that were pretty bad. And if we also have an abandonment process. If a home is abandoned in a park, mm-hmm. It gives the park the process to go through, and they can actually destroy the home, and the county would cancel the tax. But the lien does stay against
the individual.
The individual. Yes, it does.
That actually was my question. In remedy, most remedies you can do, there's a variety of remedies available to a lender. You can waive the security and sue on the debt. You can seize the asset. You can lien the debtor, personal property, et cetera, et cetera. This still leaves the liability with the taxpayer.
Yes, it does.
But it does at least alleviate the process required and the physical removal by the tax lien holder.
Mr. Chair, that basically, like, if I was to go out, if I was to follow the law, what I would have done on...
Why would we want to do that?
Well, I know. I would have actually went out and seized 472 businesses and 993 manufactured homes on November the 16th.
Right.
And to be honest with you, this kind of... We were working on a statewide collection manual, and we were doing chapters, and we came to this chapter, and somebody said... do you know that this says you're supposed to do this like after every third? And it's like, oh.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
Kind of follow up. I think it's good that we're taking our tax collectors from the point of being lawbreakers and giving them an option to make a decision.
Other questions? Hearing and seeing them, we'll close the public hearing, but first we'll ask if there's any other person here present who wishes to offer testimony on this bill. Seeing and hearing none, close the public session, open the work session.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 2030 to the floor with a due pass.
The Vice Chairman has moved House Bill 2030 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions on the motion? Hearing and seeing none, any objections to the motion? So ordered. We need to establish a carrier for 2030 and 2028. The Chair will carry 2028. Mr. Vice Chair, would you carry 2030?
Sure.
Ordered. House Bill 510. Senate Bill 510, excuse me.
Just another trailer one?
Maybe.
I'm getting excited here.
Doggone it.
Mr. Martin Mahar, could you orient the committee to Senate Bill 510?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, the Senate Bill 510, what this is doing is inserting the requirement that boundary changes be filed in a final form to the County Assessor and Department of Revenue to other pertinent statutes pertaining to cities, counties, and special districts. So really what this is doing is just putting the requirements that's already established in law in 308 to 25 into other statutes. So this is not changing current law. It has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. But just to give you a little bit of background, and you'll have testimony on this, but currently with 308-225, it's stipulating that county assessors disregard any taxing district's boundary changes if the description or map showing the changes are not filed in final approved form prior to March 31st of the assessment year. So boundary changes are including things like forming of a new district, consolidation or merging of two or more districts, annexation of territory by a district, withdrawal of territory from a district, and dissolution of a district. So even though current law already stipulates all these boundary changes, you know, that the county assessor and Department of Revenue need to be informed and need to be aware of these boundary changes, it is only stipulated in 308-225. And there is some concern that local districts are not aware of this statute, and their failure to file can cause a district to potentially lose their authority to levy property taxes in that area that's affected by the boundary change. So this is just trying to clarify in the law and help local districts who may not be aware of 308-225.
More of that customer service stuff.
Yes.
Question, Mr. Vice Chair.
I'm not sure the staff can answer this, but it seems like a conformity issue. Why wasn't that picked up by legislative council as they did the conformance in the RS?
Yes, Senator Beyer, I don't know.
We have quite a few folks who have signed up to testify on this bill. Let's open the public hearing and call forth Christina Squires. We also have... later, a three-part harmony from the Salem Area Transit, and will require the testimony from that group to be sung.
She answered all those bond bills, too.
Is there opposition to this bill?
There is none. Actually, there's the amendment that we need to talk to.
Just much talking about nothing? Just conforming?
That's our process.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In the spirit of Senator Byers, talking much ado about nothing, I'll try to be brief. I'm here today. My name is Hasina Squires. I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We represent approximately 800 taxing districts throughout the state of Oregon, including water, sewer, rural fire protection district, and irrigation districts, and many other types of districts. This bill or this concept came to our attention based upon a number of issues indicated to us by the Department of Revenue, a number of taxing districts who seem to be unaware of the requirements, as Lizbeth stated, in 308-225. Most of our districts don't have staff attorneys, and so when they do an annexation or a merger or a consolidation, they don't know. They have no... ability to read through all of the ORSs and know that 308-225 requires them to file those boundary changes with the county assessor and the Department of Revenue in order for them to levy the tax. I've attached to my testimony a section-by-section analysis of all of the statutes that we're amending. We think we've caught all of the statutes. mainly, the purpose of this bill is for us, for each taxing district to be able to look within their own enabling statute, which is where they typically look for issues relating to annexation, mergers, consolidation, to know that the requirements of 308-225 do exist, and so they don't accidentally not file their boundary change with the county assessor or the Department of Revenue. An example of this is recently the Central Oregon Fire and Rescue, Central Coast Fire and Rescue, merged with the Tidewater Walport Fire District. They did not know that the requirement existed in 308-225 to file their boundary changes with the county assessor or the Department of Revenue. The measure was passed by 78% of their voters in the district to merge the two districts together. And because they didn't file their boundary change with the county assessor, they were almost prevented from levying a tax on Walport Tidewater District, which would have created a taxing disparity. Luckily, the Department of Revenue has the ability to issue a supervisory order, and therefore the district was eventually able to levy the tax. But we really believe this is a good bill because it will help all of our small districts and some of the small cities who don't know that this requirement exists.
And the Dash One Amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the Dash One Amendments are at the request of the Salem Area Mass Transit District.
Well, of course they are.
Any other questions for Ms. Squires? Thank you, Ms. Squires. We'll go ahead and have the folks from the Salem Area Transit District. And then Mr. Phillips will back clean up the Department of Revenue. Gentlemen?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin.
Martin.
Mr. Chairman, you do not want me to try that.
I yield to the superior wisdom of Mr. Martin.
I'm Roger Martin, the Executive Director of the Oregon Transit Association, and with me are Jeff Hamm, the General Manager of Salem Area Transit, and Ben Feathersby, who's the attorney who will explain the need for this. I just wanted to add a little historical information, and Senator Corcoran just left when I was about to tell it. So, hanging on the outside of Senator Corcoran's wall facing Senator Hannon's office is a shrine to former State Senator L.B. Day. Most of you did not know him. I served with him at one time. He was a colorful, cantankerous, outspoken state senator from Marin County. And in 1979, the city of Salem ran the transit system that existed, that is now Salem Area Mass Transit District. And the city wanted to get rid of it, and they said form a district like Portland and Eugene and others have. But some of the folks here did not want it to be the same. And LB led the way to make sure that the Salem Area Mass Transit law is different than all the others in two ways. They cannot have a payroll tax. That was something that the business people here in the community, led by my colleague Fred Van Adam, made sure it didn't happen. And the other one is they couldn't set their own boundaries, which both Lane Transit and TriMet can do. And so we're here to ask you to understand that you do, because of LB Day, have the role of setting the transit districts for Salem Area Mass Transit. And with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff, who will explain this.
Senator Feroli, members of the committee, for the record, I am Jeff Hamm, the General Manager of Salem Area Mass Transit. As Roger indicates, there are two fundamental problems here. The first is that Salem Transit cannot set its own boundaries. The legislature does that. It's also a property tax-based system. In 1999, the legislature changed the district's boundaries to float with the urban growth boundary in the Salem-Kaiser area. The problem that this creates is that when the urban growth boundary changes, then it's up to the district to keep track of that. And then, according to 308.225, to file in meets and bounds those boundary changes that it is not affecting. The second, but the more fundamental problem is that the UGB doesn't necessarily follow tax parcel lines, particularly in Polk County along the Willamette River. It doesn't follow tax parcel lines. So fundamentally, if Salem Area Transit has to file the boundary along tax parcel lines, it puts the district, a special district, in the position of having to define what property is in and what property is out of the UGB. We maintain that's a responsibility of general purpose government, not the special district. With that, I'll turn it over to Councilor Featherston, who will give you some of the specifics.
Thank you. Chairman Feroli, members of the committee, my name's Ben Featherston. I'm legal counsel for the Transit District. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem. Our office has represented the Transit District ever since it was formed, and I've represented the Transit District since 1986. When the district was formed, its boundaries were set by the legislature, as was described. The boundaries set at that time were the Salem urban growth boundaries as they existed in January 1, I believe, of 1977. Since that date, The district boundaries have not changed up until the last legislative session, although the Salem urban growth boundaries did change several times after that date. So we found ourselves in a situation where we had property that was within the district, but outside of the urban growth boundary. It was being taxed by the district, but not likely to receive the extension of urban services. We perceived, the taxpayers perceived that that was inequitable. We agreed that that was inequitable, and so last session, the legislature changed our boundaries to float with the urban growth boundary as was described. The difficulty with this situation is that in reading section 308.225, if you'll turn to page 2 of the dash 1 amendments, you'll see the bottom of the page there in subsection 3, the current law defining what a boundary change means. And when we look at that, it does not trigger a boundary change when there's an urban growth boundary change that then changes the Salem district boundaries. So at the close of last session, when the district boundaries were changed to float with the urban growth boundaries, we did not prepare a map. We did not prepare a legal description because this statute didn't apply to us. In working with the assessor for Marion County, the Marion County assessor had no problem with that. In working with the assessor for Polk County, because part of the Salem district is in Polk County, he had some concerns about whether or not he had the authority to change the district boundaries in Polk County and change the tax rolls. So we worked with, we had a number of discussions with the assessors. We involved the Department of Revenue seeking to resolve this problem. And we're still hopeful that that problem will be resolved. What the effect of the Dash 1 amendments will do is to make it clear that because of the unique nature of setting of boundaries of the Salem Transit District, that the Salem Transit District is not going to be required every time the urban growth boundary changes to prepare a legal description of those of that change for the assessors. Assessors currently assess portions of tax parcels which fall both within and without of the urban growth boundary. They're capable of assessing those portions of that tax parcel differently. Because the urban growth boundary will have an effect on a property's value, assessors are able to value the portion of a tax parcel within the urban growth boundary at a higher rate or a higher value than they assess the portion that's outside of the urban growth boundary. So we don't believe that this will cause a burden make the life or work of assessors more difficult than it already is in assessing those tax parcels that are both inside and outside the urban growth boundary. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Frohley, may I add two more things? For this last tax year, we met with the Department of Revenue and a supervisory order was issued, which did properly, in our estimation, assign the tax rolls this past year. Also, in November, I met with Senator Durfler on this matter. We were going to get together with the assessors and the Department of Revenue to talk about if there could be some sort of legislative remedy. Senator Durfler has been very busy, and we haven't gotten to that topic yet. But the district is committed to working on this issue in some fashion down the line.
Questions? Senator Mayor?
Does this bill need an emergency clause? It does not have one. I'm assuming that if we change the boundaries during a legislative session, would that have an effect on that?
I'll take a stab at answering that. I don't believe that this particular piece of legislation needs an emergency clause because I don't anticipate the urban growth boundary is going to change. So right now we have a boundary that coincides with the existing Salem urban growth boundary, and that won't change until some other government body changes it.
The answer is no. Further questions for the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you guys tried to change the law so that you don't have legislators from Eugene or Southern Oregon or wherever deciding what your boundaries are? It seems kind of, local control is an issue in this, I would think. So do you guys ever come forward?
What are your questions? Out of order.
I mean, it seems kind of weird that we're all deciding on Salem's transit boundaries. It's kind of...
Well, they changed that, though.
Yeah, they now have coincided their boundary with the urban growth boundary, but the I will be willing to bet you, knowing Mr. Day, that there was a quid pro quo, and that was that the boundaries would be set in the enabling legislation, and that they couldn't grow without approval. But that was past history, I think, provided by Mr. Martin. But those days are behind us, are they not, Mr. Martin?
If I was very bold, I'd suggest you simply put Salem Area Mass Transit under the same transit law that covers TriMet and Lane Transit, but the chief presiding officer of the Senate probably would object to that.
Those days are still with us now. Does that make it clear?
I understand. Thank you.
Senator?
It appears effectively what you've done is created the authority to what the legislature did in 99 is create the authority to set those boundaries and convert it on the city of Salem with the concurrence of Polk and Marion County.
And the city of Kaiser.
And the city of Kaiser. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So that gets to your local control. Since they're all agreed to that, I would guess that the concerns about the tax assessors not knowing would be taken care of. Well, one assumes that the tax collectors at the two counties might follow the actions of the two boards of commissioners.
Mr. Vice Chair, I think there's two issues at action here. One is that we needed to clarify the date, and that's what the bill does. The amendment actually is the instructive to one tax assessor. Or any tax assessor who may be interested, if we'll put it that way.
Well, Mr. Chair, it really doesn't get at the question. They might have. It sounds like they've done it through an administrative structure.
That was for 1 year.
Correct.
That was for 1 year. This amendment's necessary to clarify in statute what is necessary every year.
What I'm sort of puzzling is you're saying you were working on legislation. This would be an appropriate piece of legislation to cause that fix in, but it may be too complicated, and we might just want to take care. Well, take this change here and let you deal with the other one as you need to.
Yeah, actually, Mr. Vice Chair, I think the testimony was that they wanted to meet with the chief presiding officer before launching that boat. So.
The amendment does not fix fundamentally the problem.
Well, I understand that. I'm just saying, I understand what this one does. I'm saying is that leaves you with a problem. And the question is really one of, do you want to try and fix it in this piece? Is that appropriate, or should we just pass this and take your chances?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe that this amendment would solve our problem because it would clearly tell the assessors that they can follow the urban growth boundary in determining the taxing boundaries of the district.
I don't think it does that at all, but okay. Either council. Well,
so in a case where there's somebody who feels they do not have authority, we could then cite this amendment in the statute and show them that they have authority.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any further questions for this panel? Hearing seen them, thank you for your testimony, albeit it was a little flat. Well, Phillips?
Were you giving him, like, one thumb up?
Not even. Nothing musical about that testimony. Mm-hmm.
Well, it didn't have anything to do with trailers. You're not expecting a lot out of this guy, are you? I mean, the last time he testified.
Good diligent. Mr. Phillips.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Senators, members of this committee, my name is John Phillips. I'm with the Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 510 without the amendment. I just saw the amendment about 5 minutes ago, so I can comment about that secondly, I hope. Hasina's testimony and Elizabeth's summary were quite on point, and I think what we have here is a situation where there are approximately 1,500 taxing districts in Oregon. And they do change their boundaries quite frequently and in various fashions, from annexations, withdrawals, consolidations, merger, dissolutions, and formations, is very complicated for an assessor to keep track of all of the changes that occur to a district's boundary. It's incumbent upon the assessor to tax properties fairly and accurately, and to make those changes is no small matter. All districts have boundaries, and just want to make a note for historical purposes that one very important boundary starts off in the state, beginning one marine league at sea off the mouth of the Columbia River at north latitude 46-15-00. And that is the beginning point for the description for the state of Oregon's boundaries. Without the boundary, not really sure under what jurisdiction the property exists. And so assessors do take this very seriously. We at the department review all of the boundaries that come in and make sure that the point of beginning and the point of the end are at the same place so that district boundaries close. And then we pass them on to the assessor's office approved, or, and then they make the changes on the tax roll so that the correct people are taxed. This bill really came as a result of the couple of situations that happen each year to taxing districts where they've failed to do this. And we're talking about a district as small as a cemetery district or a small road district or a park and rec district. We're talking about cities. Not a lot of county boundary changes, but there have been discussions about that. And so these districts hire or complete maps and legal descriptions of the boundary changes that they're going to make. Cities, for example, annex quite frequently. And those boundary changes are drawn up by usually a cartographer or a map maker. And doesn't necessarily need a surveyor, but those changes are then submitted to the department and we pass them on. I've included a couple of examples, and they're the ones that Hasina had also. We at the department have these situations come up every year, and we are very frustrated with having to make a decision about the levy, maybe leaving the levy off the roll or not taxing people that are being serviced by a district just because they failed to do this. And so we've racked our brains trying to think of a way to assist districts to help them. We often end up helping them write the boundaries, but we have a limited staff for this area too. And so what we've done in a couple of cases is we've had to issue, in very extreme cases like the one Hasina mentioned at the coast, we've actually had to issue a supervisory order and allow that work to be done by the county assessor in conjunction with our department staff. Of the 1,500 districts, now I'm going to refer to the amendment. One district is asking that the assessor's office or the department, I'm not sure who, come up with the legal description and map for the urban growth boundary. Currently, if there's a change to an urban growth boundary, the assessor would not know it. These boundaries are not filed with the county assessor, and they're not filed with the Department of Revenue. I think probably only through clairvoyance there would be no way to know what the urban growth boundary is. It's not a boundary that's used for property tax purposes. And therefore, there's no reason to file it. This issue was brought up as the testimony earlier was given. We met with the Salem Area Mass Transit District and issued a supervisory order, and I've included a copy for your information. In the first or second paragraph there, it talks about the unique characteristics of urban growth boundaries in that they sometimes follow berms, they sometimes follow high water marks, and things that don't lend themselves to accurate determination of lines with the existing property tax accounts. So since November or October, I believe, I know I was talking to Dennis Day on Friday, and he said his cartographer has been working on clearly defining the urban growth boundary for the Salem Area Mass Transit because they did not file a change, and so somebody had to do it, and we said, well, for this, both Polk County and Marion County agreed to have their cartographers do the work that would normally be required of any other district, and they've been working on that. So as to the amendment, I'm not so sure that that actually is going to cure the situation for Salem Area Mass Transit. We're not clear why they need an exception to this requirement, but that's up to you to decide. If you do decide to go this way, there will need to be some mechanism for the assessor to know where that boundary is, because, like I said, those urban growth boundaries aren't filed. In the first place, they're not filed, and in the second place, they're not to the level of accuracy for an assessor to know where those lines are relative to property tax accounts. And with that, I'm available for any questions.
Questions?
Oh, my God.
Well, I wonder if this isn't an opportune moment for a 5-minute recess to have a conference in the hallway between the Department of Revenue and the proponents of the amendment, -1, so that the committee can get clarity on whether or not this issue does or does not resolve the issue to the level of the plan. If we don't have a closing legal description or one that's filed, then the amendment appears to be questions.
Mr. Chair, did this issue come up during the last legislative session when they made this decision to go with the urban growth boundary?
Chair Farrioli, Senator Minnis, it may have. The Department of Revenue was not involved in that. We weren't even aware of the bill. So we weren't a party to that. We weren't aware of it.
Okay.
Chair's going to call a 5-minute recess. We will reconvene here at 35 minutes after 9.